So glad everyone can make it. My name is Maliha Safri, and I'm a member of the editorial board of the Brecht Forum, which is where we are. So just a couple words about what it is that the Brecht Forum does. It's very well established, long-running school that offers classes, seminars, workshops, talks and lectures like the one tonight, inviting prominent radicals, Marxists, Marxist theorists. We do classes, theoretical classes. We're running a class on from Adam Smith to Beijing on the work of Arrighi. We regularly run classes on Gramsci, reading Capital, both shorter classes on reading Capital as well as longer classes. So we have a history of being involved with both theory and praxis at this school. So we are very interested in all of those things. And this has become a space where activists from New York City come for political economy education of many different types. So tonight, we're very, very lucky to have Gaspar Miklós Tamás with us, who is a prominent political philosopher and has a long and varied life as well, and many rich stories to share with us, including being an enemy of the state and also a participant in the parliament in the 1990s. Yes. And he's gonna speak for a little bit, and he's welcomes questions and thoughts and comments. Maybe we could hold those comments for a little bit until he's able to speak, and then we'll open it up. Okay.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very proud and flattered to be here in this institution that may be modest, but it has a reputation that many people envy. Thank you. And so I would start to talk about tonight's topic, which is addressing the problem of a post-capitalist order that is particularly difficult to be addressed from a Marxist point of view, as Marxism, especially the work of Marx himself, they are not identical things, are characterized by a special kind of historicism that allows only in a very difficult fashion that ideals of the future and diverging views about a good future society to be formulated. This is caused by the character of Marxian theory, which shows to us, this is very important, both politically and philosophically, that two things that are peculiar about capitalism. One, that capitalism is one social order among many, i.e. it has a beginning and it will have an end. So Marx is regarding capitalism as a finite historical phenomenon. That's one thing. The other thing is that Marxian theory characterizes many features of human life and of society, concentrating on the aspects that are peculiar to capitalism. So what Marx has to say about labor, about exploitation, about money, about inequality, and so on and so forth, are specific views concerning capitalism, and they are not a general theory of human development and of human condition. a metaphysical theory of the human condition, be it as nuanced and subtle as it may, is most certainly not a Marxist theory. Marx's intentions are both more ambitious and more specific than that. And thereby, he's of course, has not only changed our view of economics, of the economy and of politics, but also the methodology of addressing such problems as temporal, not eternal, transient realities. And this transience and this impermanence of the modern condition is one of the substantive features that Marx establishes about modern capitalism. Now, this is well known, and this has always been, of course, the view of Orthodox Marxists, too, except the Stalinists, who thought that Marxism was a sort of a metaphysics, who thought indeed that the conflict pitting late monopoly capitalism and the Stalinist style of state capitalism one against the other was a fight between principles more than a fight between historical realities, because they wanted to see it as the end of the story. Now, in spite of all this, in spite of the radical historicism of Marxian theory, I'll come back to this, the radical historicism of Marxian theory, we are encountering, as committed people of the left, a specific problem that cannot be solved in the either empirical or historicist version of Marxism, and which has been one of the most important problems, at least for the, as the French say, le peuple de la gauche, you know, the people of the left. For these people have been the most important thing, namely the following. When communists and Marxists of various tribes were criticizing social democracy or Stalinism, one of the most important rhetorical and ideological ways in criticizing this was a normative way. Namely, they would say many people who were insurgents against social democracy and against Stalinism would say, this is not socialism. What you did, what you have introduced, what you want us to respect and to obey is not socialism, but something else. What was the title according to which they could say that? What was a definition, an objective, truthful definition of socialism that could be opposed to the pitiful reality of social democratic treason and of Stalinist terror? So therefore, we know this experientially, that people in the socialist and communist and social democratic and anarchist movements had, even if not very clearly and very explicitly, a normative idea of what socialism is, and they of course compared this ideal, as people compare ideals to reality, so did socialists and communists and anarchists compare the ideal to the reality of both struggling opposition socialist movements and even more self-declared socialist and communist parties in power. Now, so the normative problem is also a political problem in all the movements of the left, of course. If indeed we should think today, at least, well, if I, let me talk in my own name, if I had to think today that one of the greatest embodiments of the socialist idea and of political philosophy was the Stalinist system, I would say, thank you, I'd rather not be a socialist. And, you know, there are quite a number of people who feel the same. Well, then, of course, this is all very well, and we have all moral compunctions about terror and dictatorship and so on and so forth. But this is just a moralistic distaste for immoral goings on that can be found in any kind of politics. That's not, you know, terror and dictatorship and tyranny and lies are not specific to any one given social order. They can be found anywhere. But what makes us as committed socialists, Marxists, anarchists, communists, etc., to think that we are not responsible for Stalin's rule, that we are not responsible for the betrayals of social democracy, and that the ideal in which we believe is not expressed by these practices, well, this has to be answered more thoroughly than just distaste for inhuman and unpleasant behavior. So I'll give you a few examples that what has been intuitively thought by heterodox Marxist and communist movements and tendencies, because of course it's always, you know, the normative exigencies presented to reality are always, always, almost always the view and the practice of the insurgents, of the rebels, of the oppositionists, of the dissidents, and so on and so forth. Those in control, those in power, don't need that. So when revolutionaries of various tribes were thinking about the Soviet Union, the Soviet-style systems, or Maoist-style systems, and were saying, this is not exactly, or not at all, what we had in mind, they would say things such as, a real socialist or communist society cannot have and would not have wage labor, would not have commodity production, would not have money, would not have a strict social division of labor, would not have material, social, and cultural inequality, would not have state in the sense of superiority, Obrigkeitsstaat, and it would not have institutions of oppression such as army, police, prisons, camps, churches, national institutions, scientific doctrines that are obligatory, indoctrination courses in schools. In general, oppression of various kinds. So, rebels within the world communist movement would say that equality, that has always been an aim of the left, it is not precisely what communist movements are aiming at. Because equality is a consequence of various social processes, and in principle, equality can be achieved even if capitalism is kept in place. In an ideal case, which of course doesn't exist, an egalitarian and plebeian state can be invented, which by keeping private property, competition, and markets in place through various redistributionist methods can achieve equality of one kind or another. But the fact that real socialist societies of one stripe or another strove for equality and achieved a great a more profounder equality than any other state we know, that's not a sign that these societies were really going in the communist direction, because in principle this is reconcilable with exploitation, with capital, with the extraction of the surplus value on the market or through the planning process, the procedures and so on and so forth. Now, so therefore, people who were resisting official social democratic and official Bolshevik and such social orders and arrangements were characteristically arguing in a normative way. And this normative argument, moralistic and not, both, which was in itself a representative and important reinterpretation of the Marxian legacy, this has become a tradition in its own right. We all know from the history of the left that there have been, of course, many kinds of leftish rule and power, against which there's always been one kind or another of leftish resistance. And from Kronstadt to 68, we have a tradition of heterodox, rebellious, insurgent Marxism, socialism, communism, anarchism, and so on and so forth. But if we take all this seriously, and we don't regard it only as a series of historical accidents, a series of imperfections being addressed by people who've been more exigent than others, and so on. So if you really take it seriously, and we have respect for the past, you know, Eric Hobsbawm said once that he hated the terrible condescensions of posterity towards the past, and I do agree with that. I'm not willing to be condescending about especially this rebellious tradition, but we have to take it seriously and consider it theoretically too, that what can be the value of such normative resistance against various political arrangements that aimed at being socialist, at least, what is the value of these rebellions in terms of Marxian theory? And where is the moment where Marxian historicism and the rebelliousness and normativity and the moralism of rebellious movements within the tradition meet? Because they do. And well, this is my topic. And I think that we can regard, as my answer, a very tentative and very experimental answer, which of course I want you to discuss, and I'm sure that you will, and I may learn a lot from them, and then I can be perhaps more intelligent about this than I am now. But it seems to me at the moment that where indeed Marxian historicism and the rebellious normativism of the radical revolutionary tradition meets are in the following framework, that can be found in the following space, which I will describe as far as I can. It has to do, obviously, because of course, you know, there's an old discussion in Marxism that what is the, you know, the real subject of late capitalist and revolution development? Is it capital or is it the working class? In other terms, is it the class struggle? That's an old question. What drives forward the history of modern capitalism and the opposition to it? And I think that when you consider the development of capitalism, then you can find a point in which the historicism of Marx, the normative point of view of radical movements, and the experience of those exploited meet. And this is, of course, you won't be surprised, is, of course, labor, work, and which should be addressed, after all, in terms of classical political philosophy, which it hasn't been done, and which should be done in order to make it understood that the classical political cleavages that liberal political philosophy was so adept in outlining exist also in our own revolutionary tradition. Let me explain. Liberal political philosophy, which is the political philosophy that people still respect, teach, and learn, considers that one of the basic, and indeed, why not, one of the basic problems of any kind of modern community, political community, is the limit, the boundary between the public and the private. Now, the classical liberal political philosophy wants to establish, and it seems to have established, that labor as such is private in character. When you are working, you are doing that as a result of a contractual relationship. You are signing, well, physically or not, you are signing a contract according to which you are selling your labor time and labor force to the capitalist in exchange of a salary, in exchange of a labor wage, and hence the production goes forward. And but since contracts are by definition voluntary, since contracts are not imposed and normatively imposed by state authority, they belong to the realm of civil society. The private acts that are entered into voluntarily, and therefore they don't belong to the political realm, to the civic realm. And so therefore, the liberalism and democratism of contemporary societies will stop at the factory gate or at the office door. And within these contractual relationships that steer most of people's waking hours, actually, which are spent mostly, you know, in a working relationship, can be as hierarchical and tyrannical and repressive as they may be, because they have been accepted by those contractual parties who are doing the work. And this, of course, is at the basis of capitalism, because, you know, capitalism is, among other things, is based on a very simple schematic situation, namely that in order to have production and therefore to have wealth and accumulation and the rest, you need the producer and the means of production to be fused, to be one. In other words, the worker to have tools and machines and raw material and markets and so on for him to produce, not to speak of the logics and of the scientific aspects of production and so on and so forth. Now, this fusion of the producer and of means of production, when they are separated, can be, and in classical capitalism is always, operated on the market. People are indeed getting to operate the means of production, the producers without the property of means of production, but selling, as I said, you know, the labor time and labor force to the capitalist, and therefore this fusion takes place, production starts, and the whole caboodle is starting to work. Now, this is the founding act of capitalist society, the fusion of means of production and of the producer. So this is the most important economic and political and social point at which you can regard the main players in capitalist society in the light they deserve to be seen. Now, if indeed the divide between public and private is being established where it is in classical liberal political philosophy, and this divide indeed has been kept in what is called real socialism, then you have a both historical and a normative point from which you can start to judge from a Marxist or communist point of view the value, from this point of view, the value of any given modern society in which there is no biopolitical obligation, that you are obligated because of being born a peasant, a serf, a slave, to do work, but a society in which subjects are legally free, they are equal parties to contracts in principle, and this is, well, this is why Marx is such a good thinker, because he never thought that bourgeois society is not free and equal. He never thought that these were just lies of the ruling class. He knew that bourgeois societies are free and equal, and the mystery of this society is that why is there exploitation and oppression in societies in which citizens as subjects are free and equal? Well, citizens in such a society are free and equal in order to enter the labor contract in the realm of the civil society, in which free acts of will, i.e. what is private from a liberal point of view, are taking place in a realm that is safe from classical democratic and liberal politics. Now, where the revolutionary movement starts is ignoring this divide and considering the relationship of property, of division, of the separation of the producer of the means of production and the conditions in which labor relations are entered into as political problems. So you can consider, so let me just state this very dogmatic thesis, that you can consider as authentically communist or socialist any movement for which this problem is a political problem and where the public realm extends to labor. Now, in social democracy, you find that social democracy tries, as you know, and looking back from the present day reactionary politics of today, looking back nostalgically at an era where social democracy held sway and dominated politics, that's quite true that social democracy has tried, and quite successfully in many cases, to improve the tactical standing of the working class in the political struggle, especially where recompensation for work was concerned. They were improving social relationships by exercising a political influence on what was still kept within the realm of what is called even today, absurdly, the economy, as though such things existed. Of course, there's no such thing as the economy, and the economy is part of the social interactions of human beings, and it's being separated only by the capitalism to be a separate realm. Now, social democracy has kept this limitation in place and through political pressure from the outside improved the position of one of the players, which of course was conducive to great emancipatory results and so on. I'm not, of course, at all depreciating the great results of social democracy. Nevertheless, you did not need revolutionary Marxism to be a good social democrat, because exercising political pressure in order to represent the interest of the lower strata is an old tendency, humanist and democratic tendency in politics that was present already in ancient societies in that. There's nothing new in that. But the most important, perhaps politically most poignant and important case, of course, is Stalinist and Maoist so-called socialism, in which, of course, many changes have occurred. So that would be perfectly stupid to say that, you know, Soviet socialism was just the same thing as capitalism and it wasn't different. Of course, that would be silly. It was a different kettle of fish altogether. And especially as indeed the market imperatives, although they existed, weren't paramount. So the mediation, if I may introduce this term, the middle term between the producer and the means of production that in classical capitalism like today is of course the market, in which of course the price of the labor force is being established, supply and demand and so on and so forth seem to be the guiding forces even of this. Well, this was replaced in the Stalinist Soviet style commonwealth by planning. Now, it was one of the greatest conceptual errors of the supporters of the Soviet-style regimes to think that planning was not a mediation. Soviet planners and their supporters always thought that planning, that's very, very interesting actually in terms of history of philosophy, that planning was nothing else but reason injected in the anarchic processes of the economy, as though reason was or could have been a neutral term in such processes. Well, reason, if for a moment we accept this term, well, which I would be reluctant to do, but just, you know, fictionally, if we so whose reason was that? What kind of reason was that? How did the socialist planners calculate the desirable results? I'm not talking about the concrete and very interesting debates about planning and socialist calculation that took place in these regimes. There's a whole history of that, and this is I'm not equipped. I'm not an economist, but it's a very very important and an interesting chapter. And I must say that if you look at the history of planning in Soviet-style societies, you can see that the same conflicts and problems appear as in any old capitalist economic policy. Let me give you an example. In 1953, there is a discussion in the Hungarian Communist Party's Politburo between Ernő Gerő, also named Pedro, the hangman of Barcelona, a great killer of anarchists and Trotskyites in Barcelona, excellent economist and a very good translator in Hungarian of the works of Althusser, incidentally. And between Imre Nagy, future leader of the Hungarian Revolution in 56. What does the arch-Stalinist killer Ernő Gerő say? Well, comrades, we must balance the budget. That the consumption that has been assured for the working class by the populist policies of the former leadership must be stopped, and investment goods and accumulation should take the first tier, and so on and so forth, and consumption and social services should be reduced. At which Imre Nagy, the future Prime Minister of People's Republic of Hungary and the great leader of revolution, later shot by his comrades, would say the following: but comrades, this is impossible. We are, after all, not only representing rationality, mark his words, but also we are representatives, corporate representatives of the working class. If the working class living standards will plummet, what's the point in our being in power? And he carried they, and so they got indebted. I mean, it's hardly exceptional, isn't it? So these people in the leadership of communist parties were basically regarding the economy as an independent, closed thing, as a box in which if you entered on one side two, you had to have two on the other side as well. In this respect, observing the most fundamental logical foundations of the bourgeoisie. The equality of the investment and of return, and the only resource of multiplying gains through the logic of value. So in this respect, as indeed Lenin knew very well, these societies were indeed state capitalists, but the mediation between the producer and the means of production was indeed mediated by rationalistic, mathematically modeled planning that, of course, needed an other kind of leadership than, you know, a banal market capitalist society would need. So, you know, the typical leaders, because, you know, in politics it's very important, the selection of leaders and the cultural and moral character of society that of course takes place as a result. What did these societies, you know, East European Soviet societies, need for leaders? Well, they needed scholars, they needed scientists, they needed people who knew their maths, they needed intellectuals, and they needed theorists. And those states were very much what Alain Badiou calls, and Leo Strauss, the conservative thinker, calls also representatives of philosophical politics. And what do they mean by this? Well, you know, Leo Strauss speaking of Plato, and Badiou speaking of Lenin and Mao. What do they mean by philosophical politics? They mean something, for our purposes, something very simple. Namely, that in a society in which planning is the mediating power, the question of truth is primordial. If you judge the economic laws, as they call them at those times, correctly, then the results will follow. The welfare, the felicity, and the liberty of the citizens depends on the correct and true procedures of the committed scientists in the central planning office. And, well, this may sound, you know, laughable, but it isn't, because it is a very, you know, you can imagine such an order in which you can't change the original and primordial cleavages in modern society, i.e., how do you really, will you bridge the precipice between material and machinery and human beings? It sounds easy, but it isn't. So you need reason in order to bridge that precipice, and that was, of course, considered to be, you know, this kind of blueprint, algorithmic, kind of pseudo-mathematical or semi-mathematical procedure in calculating value and prices and production goals in physical terms and so on and so forth. Okay, whatever the matter with this. And I must say that with the benefit of hindsight, we can say today that planners were not, on the whole, much less successful than market doctrinaires in analyzing the economy and in giving advice to governments. You know, it's a spotty record. Certainly not an expression of the ultimate truth. But what is here socially and politically and so ideologically important is that the fusion of the producers with the means of production is not in Stalin societies either is not executed according to the producers, which at this moment would be transformed simply into human beings, will, and their philosophical and moral ideas about how to live, how much to work, what to produce, what is the rule of leisure, what are the different roles in society that in a completely free and non-coercive society can be accepted, but by rationalistic precepts that were guided by the abstract ideal of equality. Now, the abstract ideal of equality is steering not only socialist societies, but also liberal democratic societies. Liberal democratic societies are based, among other things, on ideas of classical republicanism, which stipulates, of course, the political equality of citizens, and in which there are no natural boundaries to status. And status differences in modern societies are not natural, but contractual or serendipitous, accidental. And in this modern society, the capitalist and the socialist kind were similar, with the great difference that you had in the Stalinist and Maoist, etc. societies, you had a very special organization, a political organization, that represented within this basically capitalist society the opposite principle. And that was the Communist Party. The Communist Party, through sheer politics, violence, ideological intervention, tried to do two things. One, to keep the society on egalitarian tracks, in which it failed, the party failed miserably. By the late 1960s, countries like Poland, Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia were less equal than Sweden or Japan or South Korea. And by the 80s, they were less equal than most West European countries. But they have, on the other hand, succeeded in representing what they thought it was the essential thing of the proletarian core of the society, which by that time, of course, was a minority. So the proletariat, the organized proletariat in the East European countries, had become a repressed and oppressed, but at the same time a very influential group of people that has been specifically represented by the mightiest political organization in the land, but which didn't have the power to actually steer and determine politics. Therefore, what did they have? Privileges. So the egalitarian politics of the Communist parties was indeed to keep the industrial working class quiet, but more than quiet, committed. And this was not only realized through the simple expedient of raising industrial wages only and so on and so forth, even if they were not economically viable, but also to establish various cultural and political privileges for people who actually worked in the manufacturing industries. You know, for example, I'm give you just to give you a picture of how these things went, just take culture. In every industrial enterprise, not only, but most industrial enterprises in any kind of Soviet-style country, you had a factory library in which you could request any book you wanted, and it was a lending library, so people could. Also, you had cut-price bookshops in all enterprises, which were one-third of the non-market, anyway, very, very cheap prices for books were to be had. Also, theater tickets and cinema tickets and symphonic concert tickets were sold through a special institution present in all enterprises, again at cut prices, and again, the ticket prices were, to begin with, very, very low. And but what's important, and so were, you know, various leisure activities, holidays, sports, etc., etc. And of course, positive discrimination for the sons and daughters of the industrial proletariat in education. If you were the son or daughter of a working class family, you had, in some countries, treble, in some countries, double the point, entry points of any kind of candidate for entrance in university, and so on and so forth. I can tell you in absolute confidence that I'm coming from an intellectual family, but my parents were old communists, therefore I counted as working class. Okay, so I have these points myself. I didn't use them, but you know, still I could have. Anyway, I was a good pupil, so I didn't need it. But God knows if I wouldn't have been, what would I have done? And anyway, but so these privileges for the industrial working class and its allies, and, you know, and so on, the committed core of the societies, were indeed privileged. And this privileged and committed were millions, or minority, but a minority of millions, were indeed those people who assured a very strange thing that I would call the plebeian character of Soviet-style societies. They were not equal, they were not communist, they were not revolutionary, but most certainly they were plebeian societies in which the constant characteristic of all class societies, all of us are very much used to, namely the contempt, the sheer contempt, which is culturally very important, of the ruling classes for everybody who does physical work, who has to work for a living, whose life is dedicated to inferior pursuits, earning their bread, and so on and so forth. And the symbolic hierarchy in every society in which people who are working through their spirit or soul or intellect are more appreciated than the others, which helps the acceptance of exploitation and oppression in any society that we know of, well, that didn't exist. So egalitarianism, however little Marxist it was, it had this idea of plebeian ascendancy, of plebeian superiority, in which the morality of work was extolled. Now again, here we can say again that saying and affirming in a politically representative and important way that work is good and that diligent workers possess a superior quality is going very much against the Marxian idea of communism, which of course wants to get rid of work, in which the condition of the proletariat is the ultimate position of alienation, in which the proletariat, if you wish, is the ultimate evil that has to be annihilated by proletarians themselves, the condition of being a proletarian, not the workers themselves, of course, in which there's nothing worse than being a proletarian, and that has to be self-liquidated because the proletarians are so exploited and oppressed that they have no common interest with the rest of the society. Therefore, if such a class is allowed to exist in human society, that's not a human society any longer, and all emancipation and liberation will have to be through the self-liquidation of proletariat, and so on and so forth. So extolling the virtues of labor, that is a common thread between social democrats and Bolsheviks, however much they might have hated one another, you know, those posters, the muscular workers with the hammers and all that kind of stuff, glorifying what in Marxian theory is the ultimate evil, right? And there are a few exceptions in the leftist tradition to this, 20s avant-garde, but even that flipped over, because you have one of the most representative versions of the leftist avant-garde, namely Bauhaus. Well, that is glorifying technology, glorifying work, glorifying talent in creating beautiful objects, So this is liberation through the aesthetics of labor and not by the smashing of labor. There's a great difference there. Of course, you know, we are all, you know, at least I'm a skeptic and I still prefer Bauhaus to fascist Baroque, but it's the lesser evil. It's not what we do consider, or we should, at least, if I'm right, we should consider to be the real substantive core of the emancipatory communist movements. So therefore, when we are considering labor as a problem of political philosophy, we can find a very small, I mean, you know, social terms, but philosophically very important point, in which the historicity of capitalist exploitation and the normative character of the evil that is hidden in the market mediation or the planning mediation between the producer and the means of production, there is perhaps a little seed of that might grow, from which we could, not ignoring the transience and the impermanence of the capitalist order, the impermanence of a class society in which the positions in a society are regulated by random and spontaneous processes. It's quite exceptional in history, actually. And at the same time, the normative aspirations of a revolutionary movement that is as much opposed to this mediated character of social order than it is opposed to inequality and injustice that are consequences of this, well, perhaps in this very small point we might find the first basis that could be inspiring the next steps, in which we can say that we both are trying to represent a critical point of view that recognizes some conceptual and empirical features of capitalism without any illusions, but which has a vital link to the normative aspirations of a committed revolutionary movement that wants to put an end to the humiliation of human beings. Thank you.
There's a couple things. Well, there's a lot that you said, obviously. The idea of the split, the private-public split, also being mirrored in the split between the economy and politics, I thought that was... that
it is close to that. It's not identical, but it's almost the same thing.
So
parallel.
It's parallel. Why is it not the same thing?
Well, it's just a question of approach. I mean, division between the economics, the economy and society and politics and so on and so forth is a kind of a structural description of modern society that I happen to believe to be incorrect and indeed serving a purpose. So here I would be very intolerant. And I'll try to in a few words to explain why. And the public and private, of course, is an older division, and of course because there are overlapping spaces between public and private in the old differentiation between two. You know, because of course, you know, you create revenue in the private realm, but those are being taxed, so they become, so the common good has a claim on these private processes, the common good represented by government. So of course redistribution can take place legally and morally, in a morally accepted fashion, also in exploitative class societies. And so therefore the public and private, because being an older division, will of course occlude much more than the more modern differentiation between economy and politics would do. And you know, the main difference, of course it can be defined in many ways, but the main difference is the following. The economy is primarily seen by the players that be nowadays, in the last 400 years, that the economy satisfies needs, right? Needs of the consumers, on the one hand. It's an indirect way to satisfy consumers in large, complex societies in which the consumers of the various goods are not identical with the producers of those goods, okay? And on the other hand, also, they will satisfy the competitive and acquisitive instincts of people who want gain, who want to, not only do they want to satisfy their primary needs, also they want gain, they want more large and improved possibilities and so on and so forth. Therefore, this has to be competitive and has to be random, because people, of course, are trying to invest their goods and also their skills and their energies and so on and so forth in this world in which we A, to satisfy our needs, and B, we are fashioning and refashioning our needs in an ever-growing way, and therefore there's an eternal competition and so on and so forth. And these are basically relationships, competitive and similar relationships, between private people for their private gain. Mm-hmm. Well, this is nonsense. This is nonsense, of course, because not all actors in the economy are the same. And the difference between them, such as property owning and the propertyless and so on and so forth, and the you know, physical workers, the intellectual workers, and other cleavages within this, are determined politically. And these cleavages are sustained through legitimate coercion, which we call politics or law. And law in general, punitive and penal law and civil law, are the methods in which both the separation and the unitary character of this order are being created. So therefore, in a society in which both power and the economy are decided by law in a competitive way, i.e. distributing roles, are leading or you know, obeying roles, the differentiation between the two is artificial. Mm. It's artificial. You have a distribution and redistribution of goods, services, roles, social capital, cultural, etc., etc., in a dual system, one in the market, the other through the state. This is well known. And they have always been only relatively differentiated. The difference is, of course, that legally the state has an authority that people on the market don't seem to have. This is the main truth of bourgeois society. So it is not unjust, because after all, you have to differentiate between legitimized state aims and state practices that have to obey a superior morality, and private pursuits that, of course, will follow private aims and interests. Well, is that true of the propertyless engaged in a technologically ruled, uniform production activity that is being technologically subordinated to the will of capital and of representatives of capital, and in which your time, your respiration, your bodily needs, your skills and your intellect are being subordinated? If that is not a political subordination, then I don't know what political subordination is, right? So what can be a greater power than to say to anybody, you will turn up at 8? Okay? Isn't your freedom not curtailed? Well, it is curtailed, but you have, of course, to acquire. But don't you acquire in the curtailing of your liberty when you go under the flag to serve in the army? Of course you do. These things are much more parallel than they seem. And in this respect, I must say that our adversaries, the Conservatives, has sometimes a very sober view, because they are less hypocritical than Social Democrats or Liberals, representing cynically, you know, the power of the ruling class. They like Nietzsche, you know, like Simone Weil, they knew perfectly well that this was slavery, and state slavery and private slavery, well, you know, morally they weren't that different. You know, when Simone Weil describes the Iliad in her immortal essay, Le Poème de la Force, when she says that, what is the Iliad about? About submitting to superior physical and political power and the suffering that comes from it. So what is Achilles doing? Well, you know, he won't fight until he's not assured that he will leave the battlefield as a free man. This is why he refrains from fighting. So, yeah. And so people knew that, and they knew that, you know, for a very, very long time. And Nietzsche, who said that no civilization is possible without slavery, and in this he thought the same as Aristotle and as Marx. Because you see, the Greeks were pretty realistic in thinking that there's only one kind of real human freedom. The freedom of leisure. Freedom of leisure. Whoever has to work for a living, i.e. constrained and obligated to work, cannot be a free person. And so in Athens, you know, whoever had to work for a living didn't have the vote. Only people who could sacrifice their lives completely and wholly to public affairs and to non-interested pursuits such as art, sports, and eroticism, those were the only free people. And this is true. And the definition of liberty in Marx is based on the idea of leisure, and as opposed to labor. And so Marxian movements, if they are really that, mean fights against labor, not against laborers.
But is it the process of labor, or is it the conditions of labor that are alienating?
Both. Process of labor, of course, you know, that was a very cunning question to be asked, because, you know, process of labor is a very neutral expression, can mean several things, so what I have in mind, well, in our collective mind, not in my own mind only, is that when, of course, labor is an obligation that cannot be legitimized, well, that's the labor what is really reified and alienated. The process of labor, when there are no external constraints on your time and on your body, and such processes of labor can be devised and are sometimes, you know, for some privileged, lucky people, well, that in itself, if you have to keep that expression, there's nothing to be objected to, but I'm not sure that you should keep that expression. Maybe you should. I'm unsure.
I have other questions, yes, too, but I don't want to monopolize everyone's time, and I'm happy to take questions from the audience.
I have a question about the implication of broadening the definition of socialist or communist politics to include all things that address, or rather, I think your explicit formation was to extend the political or the public to include labor relations, or that is to say the mediation between the producers and the means of production. My intuition here is that the implications of this actually reflects on your decision to really polarize the historicist and the normative strains of Marxist thinking. This is to say, and I found that actually quite strange, despite some of your response to the last question by the moderator, that, I mean, you want to, you know, emphasize the historical, you know, aspect, and yet when you begin with liberal political philosophy, right, I mean, of course there is always this distinction between the public and the private, but this was, you know, very much, I find, rhetorical and ideological, right? We do not need to arrive at late capitalism to realize that the state, I mean, obviously one of the fundamental conditions in the creation of the market as a separate realm, so to speak, was for the state to engage in primitive accumulation and to guarantee the sanctity of private property and you know, contract relations. So the state has always been involved, and of course Marx himself in, for instance, on the chapter in the Working Day, already shows that even in bourgeois societies, that the mediation precisely between the workers and the means of production has always been politically contested. And yet, despite this, you you know, start with this public-private distinction as your starting point, and then want to include within your definition of socialist and communist politics everything that challenges this. The reason why I mention this is because then I find it equally possible to look at ongoing politics, realpolitik, here in the United States, as much as we can look at, as you know, your example showed, social democracy, and even Bolshevism. And all these three strands, quite varied, I would say, could equally fall under your definition of communist or socialist politics.
On the contrary, they all fall under the definition of capitalist.
That was precisely going to be my next question. In separating out the empirical, the historical, and the normative strains of Marxism, I think there's a certain way in which you actually, I think, divert our gaze from what constitutes the key mechanisms of, well, of the functioning of capitalism as a mode of production. I mean, I'm not saying that Marx provides a mechanistic view of how capitalism works, but I think it would be fair to say, I mean, for instance, that the circuit of capital, right? It's constant, you know, valorization, expansion. I mean, I think it would be fair to say that these things constitute the core dynamics of what capitalism is. And I think in order to combat this, we don't necessarily need to fall into what you're calling this normative versus historicist, you know, strains of Marxism. In fact, I think we would have to address them concurrently. And lastly, this is a slightly different point. At several points, I was actually thinking about this differentiation between the empirical, historical, and the normative in relation to various theories of democracy, because I felt your move, again, you know, in defining what is, you know, communist or socialist politics to be a kind of a minimization of what socialist or communist politics might be, and something akin to, for instance, what Schumpeter does to a definition of democracy. That is to say, offer a very minimal definition of it. And in thinking about democracy, for instance, and the thing is, I don't want to say or be a high-minded, lofty idealist, right? And to, you know, cling to these you know, ideas about, you know, equality and freedom without connecting them to actual political programs. This I do not want to do. I also do not want to advocate, for instance, Derrida's idea of democracy to come and say that, well, the ideal always eludes us. We could only, you know, struggle. But by the same token, for instance, when we think about democracy, of course we ought to be able to think about democracy as a system and to improve it institutionally. By the same token, I believe it would be just as possible to think of democracy as a kind of a struggle, a constant struggle, and to think about the principle of contestation, right, as being at the core of democratic praxis. And in that sense, while we ought to strive at the same time for achieving a particular system, this normative strain that manifests in constant struggle ought not to be looked down upon.
The first half of your contribution, I'm largely in sympathy. I would too like to see these things concurrently, as you propose. And there's a question of presentation, and of course my respect for a tradition of debate in which these things have been asked and asked again, and this has a certain political relevance. And my respect for this tradition was that, to put it in quite traditional terms, if you wish, I don't have anything against that. So I would think that, yes, the fact that I mentioned, although I think it's very important, also I have no contempt for liberal political philosophy as such at all, the public-private divide, that's of course a very important one in the self-understanding of bourgeois societies, and I present it just, I want it at least, perhaps I didn't succeed, but I want to present it as a conventional divide, which still influenced people's view on what constitutes acts that are not in need of legitimation. That was my point, which I perhaps didn't emphasize sufficiently, and here your queries are quite justified. Well, on chapter two of what you have said, I found very interesting, as well as the first part, which I sympathize with. The second part I don't sympathize so much, for the very simple reason that I really don't any longer, I don't feel able to separate out the idea of democracy from the rest. So I guess that intuitively, as far as I can see, you're quite right that in what you said about political programs and such, and about democracy being something more than an eternal approximation of a not even openly envisaged ideal. But I can hardly, and here I'm more pessimistic than you are, perhaps, if I understand you correctly, I hardly can envisage a real fight for democracy, although I'm doing it myself with a false consciousness, that would totally disregard the inbuilt alienated element in all of these. You see, so I'm like every leftist person. I would sign protests and go in demonstrations for various rights and so on, although the whole concept of rights is problematic and so on. I will do those things, not because I'm dishonest, well, not perhaps not only because I'm dishonest, but because of a partial acceptance, a grudging acceptance of those cleavages in present-day bourgeois society that I philosophically do not really recognize as being valid. And so I would say, refugees are being badly treated, tortured, kept in camps, and so on and so forth. You can't wait. You have to protest. Yes, but of course, if you regard this, what is it? What do you mean protest? This presupposes a view of reason that we don't really accept. It regards that it can be rationally threshed out that in any kind of society there's a criterion of justice and fairness and so on that you could claim and you could oppose to the powers that be and so on and so forth. Now, of course, we have to do this not out of philosophical conviction but out of human sympathy and such elementary moral convictions. But at the same time, you ought to know that such reason doesn't exist. That such reason exists only if you do accept its separation from the individual acts personified or embodied, rather, by alienated labor, which is the model for contractual, i.e. civil society acts and transactions between human beings and between private persons. Now, this is an inherent difficulty, because we are always, and this is what makes the radical left interesting, if you wish, philosophically interesting. We are always on this double track, on the whole, recognizing the, although preferring heterodox approaches too, but recognizing the validity of reason that can adjudicate merit in the most abstract sense. And at the same time knowing that this ideology, presupposing that this ideology is flawed not because it's hypocritical or mendacious, but because it is naive, because it doesn't see that the impersonal imperatives of capitalism, of accumulation and so on and so forth, circulation, you know, valorization and overvalorization of capital and so on and so forth, goes on in between, that subordinates sovereign acts and transactions between people in which the sovereign reason cannot appear as a governing force. Therefore, democracy, if you take it seriously, and you seem to, in capitalist circumstances, is severely circumscribed, and it will be always philosophically ambiguous. And I wish it weren't. You know, that's because political struggles are very difficult. And if we, and this is one of the reasons why, in the last 30, 40 years, so many radicals had become liberals, which is not an accusation, of course, why not, but that at all. But it explains, you know, the technique of it. Because, you see, not only because, you know, radicalism is hopeless and liberalism may offer some rewards. I'm not thinking of that. That plays a role too, of course. But what I have in mind is that if the posture in which you withdraw every legitimacy from acts that in the official ideology are considered to be spontaneous, free and sovereign, then political pursuits within bourgeois society become well nigh impossible. And the feeling of solidarity, which is again, you know, a constitutive normative, well, intuition of people on our side, as it were, would be severely contradicted by refraining from these fights. And this is always the problem of radicalism. If you look at today's radicals, the French people who publish in Ticoun, you know, the coming insurrection, those people, you know, and the new French radicals, well, they say, and they're very consequent to that, that democratic struggles for the undocumented aliens, etc., etc., are totally useless and are helping only, you know, the exploitative world order to poison all social transactions and poison especially the minds of people and so on and so forth. Therefore, only atomic acts are reasonable and only destruction is permissible. And of course, you know, this is a kind of radicalism that people, of course, will refuse, and which, although absolutely consequent and clever, will contradict the fundamental moral intuitions of all the emancipatory movements. So it's not only social democracy and Bolshevism that has its moral problems, but very consequent and very philosophical radicalism has its own moral problems too. That goes against the grain of our moral intuitions, which I would not just, you know, dismiss with contempt. And so, therefore, you know, the problems you're posing are very real ones, and of course, my answer is very partial.
Basically, a few questions. First of all, how well do you think your essay, Telling the Truth About Class, hold up now? In light of the recent economic crisis, especially given that questions of social economic class and critical stances on political economy remain obscure, and also the fact that the left remains fragmented now? And secondly, what's the state of the left in Eastern Europe after the Cold War?
Well, my answer to the first question is, you know, it's, well, probably some reformulations will be needed. I won't expatiate on that because not everybody has read that. And but I would think that one aspect of that essay I'm still in agreement with, namely that I do consider that only capitalist societies are authentic class societies, and that in that respect the Communist Manifesto is mistaken, that not all societies known hitherto have been class societies, caste societies, and that's different. And caste and or estate and class are different phenomena, and I really think that the novelty and the originality of capitalist society are even more radical than Marx. But of course this is perfectly coincidable with the Capital, not with the Manifesto. And I think that class is a consequence, not a primordial fact, and that the reformulation of social difference on biopolitical lines, as in caste societies, one of the greatest dangers that is facing humankind now. Look at contemporary politics about health, race, immigration, gender, etc. Now, so that's my answer. So, you know, but of course, my emphasis on a new proletarian politics, that has a little bit evaporated. Yeah. So the rhetoric towards the end of that essay, it doesn't hold up very well. I wish, but no. The second, left in Eastern Europe, well, that's, everybody knows that that's a very feeble left. Although this is changing, well, first of all, there is a change in some countries, not in all of them, that there is an intellectual left that hasn't been the case in a long, long time, since the 70s, when there's been the revisionist, it was called, not always was actually, in real conceptual sense of the term. You know, the critical Marxists have existed in the 70s. Since then, there wasn't such a group, and now there is young theorists, writers, artists, intellectuals, philosophers, political analysts, whatever, who, without any permission or against all predictions, have begun to see the world through radical lenses. Like everywhere else, this is not linked to the movement. And of course, that's a very important thing, you see, because, you know, traditional, not traditional, but old radicalism was institutionally housed in the movement. As I just discussed with a friend of mine the other day, you know, what did Rosa Luxemburg do? Well, she was teaching at a party school. She was teaching at the trade union seminars. She was writing for the party press. She didn't want to become an academic. Not only that she wouldn't have been, of course, hired by a German university, but also she wouldn't have the time. She was engaged. Engaged in the movement, and of course, modestly, but paid by the movement. And there were thousands of intellectuals who were parts of the counterculture in the very serious sense of the term, not only morally counterculture, but that was, of course, socially and economically and politically a different, you know, the adversary. And that is the great and immortal merit of the old workers' movement, that whatever happens, and in spite of everything, and the self-delusions of being really communist, or in spite of that, they have created something that really, I'm repeating this, and the risk of boring some people, that is the first political power in the world that had created for a subaltern class a genuine and authentic and autonomous culture that was a real challenge to the culture of the ruling class. Not only folklore, not only complaint, not only plaintive and angry folk songs, but an autonomous sociology and philosophy and economics and literature and art and party and civil society movements, the world, the whole world hostile to the powers that be. So a subaltern class, although it didn't achieve its main aim, it had increased in dignity and in power to an extent never seen in world history. It's absolutely unique. There's no precedent for that. Well, think of the slave uprisings and the peasant revolt. Yeah, there's no comparison. And this is a huge achievement. And we, I mean, our generation, largely, I mean, those who are still alive at this moment, young and old, we have not had the talent and the imagination to invent political forms that would at least parallel that unique achievement. So now, of course, you have trade unions and, you know, largely, you know, parties largely based on working class constituencies and such like. They still exist. Of course, they participate in the usual competition for redistribution goods in the normal way of bourgeois politics. And nothing wrong with that in itself, obviously, but of course it does not parallel. And here is something that, of course, because of having been a dissident and opposed to East European dictatorships, I have not seen well enough. Well, that's the nature of a fight. That makes you, you know, short-sighted in some respects. That what a role these societies played, symbolically at least, as the opposite pole, as the, you know, as the other world, as it were, for the movements in the West.
I
mean the Soviet system that appeared symbolically as another world, as the other world of the West, which for many people in the workers' movement at least has shown, at least in a fantasy world, at least conceptually, that, you know, what the movements of today express, that an other world is possible, right? And it seems to them that indeed the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China and Vietnam and Cuba and blah, today, God, you know, Chavez is Venezuela and all that, would constitute, you know, a different world, which of course inspired people and strengthened their belief in having something that was not bourgeois. Of course, and here, you see, again, going back to the class thing, it seems now that the bourgeois class formation, the proletarian class formation of classical capitalism is just one phase of capitalist history. And modern capitalism seems to have survived the politically and social and culturally circumscribed class formations. The old bourgeoisie doesn't exist as much as the old committed socialist working class doesn't exist either. So not only the proletariat, the old industrial proletariat with the raised fist and all that beauty has disappeared, but also Thomas Mann's and Marcel Proust's bourgeoisie as well. And you don't have that any longer, or Flaubert's for that matter. And it's not only questions of Philistinism and culture, but also I don't think that individual firms and family firms and the bourgeoisie as a class, as a player in the cultural and local and social politics of the world, plays the role it had. No, it doesn't any longer. You know, this is managers and civil servants and bureaucrats and so on and so forth playing the same role. Just because I don't want to speak too much, I mean, just think of the big cities of the early 20th century. What was the distance measured in kilometers between the working class and the government in Paris, or in London, or in Berlin, or in Budapest? Well, in Budapest, I calculated this. In Budapest, if you came from the south, the Red Chapel, that was the, you know, the red working class district, that is 5 kilometers, that can be done by a mass of people in 4 hours. From the north, in Ongjarfeld, that's only 1.5 kilometers, that can be done under an hour. So if you wanted to smash power, and if there was no great military resistance, the proletarian majority of Budapest could occupy the main buildings of the government, parliament, national bank, royalties, in 5 to 6 hours. Now, to find in contemporary capitalism the real center of power, for people living in the global suburbs somewhere, you know, it's even conceptually difficult. You can't even measure it in physical time. You know, where is the center? Or where's the periphery? And capitalism is flourishing, among other things, because of this, because of logistics having changed in its favor. So, you know, now your friends are occupying Wall Street. Well, I'm leaving tomorrow, so I can't, but I would come too. But, you know, but they won't be able to occupy their laptops. But this was always, of course, that's not new. There was always an aspiration of capitalism to make this logistics more advantageous to the powers that be. Hence, you know, the Haussmann reforms of Parisian architecture, so well described by Walter Benjamin and others. So this is not new, but they keep succeeding. They keep succeeding even at the price of actually giving up on the direct cultural and political class power of the bourgeoisie. And also, to add a gloomy note to this, well, the first system in which capitalism was preserved by the direct political and social and cultural power of the bourgeoisie has been dissolved was, of course, Nazi Germany. But the bourgeoisie lost its political privileges but kept the profits. And we're still living with the consequences, and this line's going on. And therefore, you know, the invention of new political forms is crucial. It would be crucial that would address this, you know, for the moment, inimaginably great political distance between the powers of the establishment and the powers of the barely existing counterpart.
I think we have time for one more question.
Oh, you wanted to ask?
Okay, I do actually have. I mean, you mentioned on a. Sorry.
You have three or four.
I do.
I have
time for one, I suppose. So, you mentioned on a few occasions. Migration, right? And one interesting thing that I thought about, and I'd like to know what you think, is if we consider what you said about liberal political philosophy, right, and creating the boundary between that which is public and private, and labor and what goes on inside the firm becomes private in character, and then simply because it is a voluntary relation. So that which is voluntary is equated with private acts. And in some ways that's remarkably similar to the way migration is also treated, right? That which is,
cool.
It is...
It all turns on the concept of citizenship.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so I was thinking of a slightly different aspect of this, which is when migrants are understood to be voluntary versus when they're forced to move, right? Being forced to move categorizes them as being refugees, and somehow entering into the voluntary relation removes them entirely from any kind of sphere of protection. In fact, precisely because it is considered a voluntary act, it is also a criminal act, right? The undocumented emerge as not, it ceases to be a political process.
It ceases to be a process that is actually structured by larger macro conditions, by political conditions, and it becomes simply a voluntary act that is entered into by these particular undocumented criminal folks, right? And so what does it mean that, so if the task of the socialist, of the communist, is to sort of bust up that division, that artificial and arbitrary division, what do we do then with this division between the refugees and the migrants?
Yes. You're very lucky, because I wrote an essay about this, and it has appeared in the year of 2000 in the Boston Review, if anybody's interested. It's called On Post-Fascism,
okay.
In which I was trying to show that, you know, the aspiration, the striving of the Enlightenment and of modern democratic and liberal movements was to define civic rights as being ever closer to human rights, i.e., the human rights from being universalized. And so citizenship that under, you know, Kantian Enlightenment guidance, which had, of course, a great effect on many international law and constitutional law practitioners, from a universal condition to be attained, had re-become or had become a privilege. So citizenship is now the main instrument of discrimination. And fascism and National Socialism were peculiar, among other political tendencies, including all sorts of authoritarian nationalistic political arrangements and views, that they put the line between friend and enemy, to use Carl Schmitt's theory, not between our citizens and the foreign countries, but within the national boundaries. So some categories that were domestic, Jews, say, communists, whatever, were declared to be enemies of state. So the protection of constitution and the state all legal inhabitants of one territory, that has been withdrawn. Now, that withdrawal is being now repeated in a world in which the link between citizenship and territory and citizenship and ethnicity are untenable because of the great movement of not only of human beings but of various other things, capital and so on and so forth. And so there's an increased number of human beings in the contemporary world without any kind of citizenship and legal protection, which goes against the most fundamental definition of democracy. So I said, you know, that was, of course, 10 years ago. I said that if this is like we see it is, if this continues to be the case, then all this talk about democracy is totally ridiculous. And because democracy, although I don't associate with it the best definition and so on, but it means something. It means that people on the whole are parties to politics conceived as a handling and running and participating in public affairs in which human beings are primordially equal. Now, if there are permanent differentiations between citizens and non-citizens, and between i.e. mere human beings, that has been later theorized by Agamben and so on, that just mere human beings who have no political dimension, and therefore they're in the camps, and you know, there's an article in today's New York Times about, you know, even this has been outsourced, there are also huge firms keeping, private firms, keeping legally tens of thousands of people in custody, which of course is totally, you know, inimical to any kind of law that has been valid until now. And so we, in our society, are recognizing increasingly that they are people whose mere existence is not legitimate. And we recognize that for the first time after the Second World War, that these universal claims about rights and so on and so forth are not universal. And this is recognized by states, and most serious, most important, more powerful states that are now declaring that there are human beings who have a political dimension and there are human beings who don't. Well, that I consider to be a very great change. And there have been always contraventions and brutalities and so on and so forth, but now it's even legally and doctrinally, this is defined like this. And that just shows, there are many other examples as well, but this too shows to what an extent the egalitarian ethos of bourgeois democracy has gone down in the contemporary world, yes. So yes, I do agree with you, because these boundaries, of course, between citizen and non-citizen, or, you know, private, party to private contract, or obedient citizen, law-abiding citizen, these differentiations are artificial. And, of course, yeah, it's also our conceptual interest and also our moral interest to go against these differentiations and show their fictitious character and show them for what they are, i.e. manifestations of power.
Well.